Our next case of the morning is number 05-2596, the United States against Wiley, and number 05-2663, the United States against Brown. Mr. Rayl.
Good morning. Samuel Rayl from Atlanta, dealing with defendant Claude Wiley, Jr. If the court has obviously read the briefs, and it would be impossible to determine anything except that the instruction as given by the judge was factually inaccurate. The question, and what I want to convince this court of this morning, is that that instruction seriously affected the fairness of the trial, the integrity of the trial, and the public reputation of that trial. As well as it affected the outcome of the trial. Because in this particular case, the situation is that we had two people, Bailey and Collier. And in this case, there were no, as I have often had in many of my trials, there were no wiretaps, there were no surveillance, there was no half a dozen, baker's dozen witnesses, there were not any code words. The case rose and fell based upon these two people's testimony and therefore their credibility. The case, therefore, rose and fell on them, and they failed in this case because the credibility instruction was totally inaccurate, as my brief indicates. And this is, in fact, a rare case in which when an instruction is inaccurate, it has to affect the integrity of the trial. Because I looked at the United States Attorney's table of authorities, and the one case that I was concerned about that they didn't mention was the Collins case. And I looked at that case because that case deals with this particular jury instruction. In that particular case, they were dealing with a situation where they felt like the jury was not confused or misled. But in this case, there would have been confusion and misleading instructions, because in this particular case, there was only one conspiracy alleged in the case. Judge had said in his instruction that both Bailey, who was a confidential informant, and a government agent, therefore, were involved in the commission of the offenses as charged in the case, and yet, in fact, they were not, neither of them, neither Bailey nor Collier. And therefore,
one of them could have been charged, right? And the deal with the government was that he would not be, and that was the consideration.
Well, the consideration is only one aspect of it, but there's another aspect of it, isn't there? And that is that the judge said that both of them were involved in the commission of the offenses as charged, and yet they were not involved in the commission of the offenses as charged. How, in fact, could Bailey, a government agent, been involved in the conspiracy? If that would not cause confusion to a jury, I don't know what would.
The other guy was involved, right? So it's just with respect to one of the witnesses?
No. The other guy wasn't involved and never said he was involved in the commission of the offenses either.
I thought he was buying drugs from your client.
Yeah. There was a count three where there was distribution of cocaine hydrochloride. There was a count four of possession with intent to distribute more than 50 grams of cocaine base, and then there was this first count of conspiracy. And in those counts, none of them, neither of these two, said that they were involved in the commission of all the offenses as charged. They may have been involved in one particular count, but not all those counts.
Is there legal support for parsing it out like that?
Parsing out what,
Parsing out the instruction like that? You're alleging instructional error. Is there legal support for the proposition that the witness for whom this cautionary instruction is being given has to be involved in all of the offenses, or just
Well, that's
some,
what the judge said, and would that not be confusion is my point. The judge said that both of these witnesses were involved in the commission of all the offenses as charged, but they weren't. And the judge also said that they were involved, as the court has just indicated, to receiving a benefit from the government in connection with the case. And they weren't.
Well, one got a forbearance from the government in exchange for testimony, right?
Well, no.
And the other got a deal in state court?
One got a forbearance in the state court with Vigo County.
Okay, so I got it mixed up. One got forbearance in state court, the other got what in federal court?
They decided that they would, I believe, if I remember, they would reduce the statutory minimum sentence.
Right, not include the prior felony.
Right.
So that reduced it by almost 100 months, didn't it?
I think it did.
Yeah. That's a big benefit, isn't it?
That's a benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. Mr. Crawford.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jack Crawford, and I am the attorney from Indianapolis representing co-defendant, co-appellant Tatu M. Brown. Mr. Brown entered a conditional plea of guilty to these charges under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11A2, reserving the issue of the trial court's denial of his motion to suppress evidence. It is a contention of Mr. Brown that there were insufficient facts submitted to the United States magistrate to establish probable cause to justify the issuance of the warrant that was served on January 16th of 2003 at 2320 Second Avenue in the city of Terre Haute, Indiana. The entire evidence in support of the issuance of the warrant is contained in the affidavit submitted by Special Agent Zolte of the Drug Enforcement Administration. And that affidavit, in the opinion of the defendant, Brown, is insufficient to establish probable cause. This affidavit, Your Honors, is long on broad generalizations and sweeping conclusions and short on the facts. Basically, the affidavit is comprised of the apparent statements of three cooperating persons, one a cooperating source, two a confidential informant who had been arrested on drug trafficking charges. The main import of the affidavit is based on CI number one, who apparently told agents after his or her arrest on cocaine trafficking charges that all of his cocaine had been supplied since 1999 from Mr. Tatu Brown, and that he had seen Tatu Brown cook up cocaine at his house, all sorts of broad allegations. There's no corroboration for CI one. The district court relied on the fact that CI one apparently was giving a statement against penal interest after he or she was arrested on cocaine trafficking charges in relaying this information to federal agents. Your Honors, I recognize the case law that gives some credibility for purposes of a search warrant to persons who have been arrested, but I've always marveled at the position, if you will, of someone getting caught with their hand in the cookie jar and then going on to say that person is being truthful and credible about why they were stealing the cookies, at whose behest they were taking the cookies, all kinds of other statements.
I thought, counsel, that two of the three confidential sources whose information was contained within the warrant application identified your client as a drug dealer from whom they had long purchased drugs.
Judge, CI2 said he bought marijuana from Mr. Brown. He doesn't say when that happened, doesn't say how that happened, doesn't offer any facts to support that broad conclusion. CI2 says that. CI1 says he was buying cocaine from Mr. Brown, but once again, no facts to support it. When were the purchases? How were the purchases made? What kind of quantities? No corroborating facts, just a conclusory statement. I got my cocaine from Mr. Brown. And then, in addition to the lack of credibility, the lack of facts to support the credibility of the confidential informants, Your Honors, there are no facts that support a nexus between Mr. Brown and 2320 Second Avenue in Terre Haute, Indiana. Police say they saw him there two times. Once he brought groceries in. They interviewed a postal employee who says that he had delivered mail at some unspecified time in Mr. Brown's name to that address, but insufficient facts to lead a reasonably prudent magistrate to conclude that there was evidence of contraband or criminality at 2320 Second Avenue in Terre Haute.
So even if we agree with you that it was thin, how do you get around Leon? Because there wasn't any evidence that this was just a rubber stamp by the magistrate, was it?
Judge, it is.
Or that the officer submitted an affidavit so lacking in the indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence entirely unreasonable. I mean, how do you deal with that case? Because that's a big problem for you.
It is, Judge. I understand the good faith argument is a steep hill to climb for this defendant appellant. But nevertheless, we feel that this affidavit was so deficient and so short on facts and so long on these broad generalizations that Officer Agent Zolte should have known that it would not justify probable cause to establish a search. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. We'll hear now from Mr. Blackington.
Good morning. May it please the court. I would like to first address the corrupt sources instruction. And the first thing I'd like to do is make sure we have our facts straight here. There were two corrupt sources that testified for our government. The name were Timothy Bailey and Michael Collier. Both defendants received a benefit from the government in this case. As far as Michael Collier, as the court noted, it was the government's agreement not to file an 851 information, which cut his sentence from 20 years to approximately 10. The second was Timothy Bailey, who received a benefit both in federal and state court. In federal court, he wasn't charged in this conspiracy, and in state court, he received a lesser sentence. Both defendants testified that they were involved in the commission of the offenses with the defendant. Michael Collier testified that he got his cocaine from Claude Wiley for several years. And although Timothy Bailey was a government agent and informant, he was an informant on one instance in a controlled buy late in the charge conspiracy. For the years preceding that controlled buy, he testified, yeah, I was involved in that offense. I took trips to Chicago with Claude Wiley to bring cocaine back. I distributed powder and crack cocaine for him in the street. So both of them said that they were involved in the commission of the offenses. And as far as Michael Collier, he did plead guilty to an offense arising out of the same occurrence for what Wiley's on trial. He pled guilty to, I think, two counts of distributing crack cocaine, and he testified that that crack cocaine came from Mr. Wiley. So that comes out of the conspiracy in the case. The defense attorney's argument in this case is essentially that the judge could have written the instruction in a little more coherent way, so I should get a new trial. Fortunately for us, the plain error standard doesn't quite operate that way. There was no objection to the instruction from the trial counsel. The instruction was specifically argued in the closing argument for the defense trial counsel, citing the fact that the judge did give an instruction. instruction in corrupt sources and that the jury should follow it. I think it was clearly understood who that instruction pertained to. This was a 2 or 3 day trial. It was very short. And I think, you know, the standard is in G, could the trial court have written the instruction better? The legal standard here, because there's no objection to the instruction, is a plain error standard. Was the defendant's constitutional rights violated by this instruction? I don't think that can be said in this case. And the other point on the special caution instruction is that this court has said in the past that it does not require a corrupt source instruction at the onset, that general credibility instructions are sufficient, and we're not going to require a corrupt source instruction in the Seventh Circuit.
The question here, if you give one, you can't give one that misleads.
I don't think it's misleading, but let's say that
that's the issue, though, isn't it?
Well, there are two, Your Honor. Let's assume for a moment, and I'm not suggesting this, but let's assume that this instruction's completely misleading and the jury has no idea who this instruction's tailored for, okay? They have no idea what witnesses that this applies to, and they completely disregard the instruction. If they do that, they're in the same position as if the instruction was not given, and the Seventh Circuit has said that's okay, that the instruction's not given. But I don't. This instruction, sure, it can be tweaked a little bit, and it might read better, but we can say that of every trial. And if the legal standard was, gee, could the instruction have been tweaked a little bit better, and maybe the judge should have named who the two witnesses are, you know, if that was the case, we'd be trying every jury trial multiple times. With the court's indulgence, I'd like to pass to the document search warrant issue. We start from the premise of Lehman that in the case of drug dealers, evidence is likely to be found where the dealers live. And we have several different sources that were mentioned in the search warrant. The principal one is individual number one. Individual number one is the main person who says that Tatu Brown's a crack dealer. He's received crack and distributed for him for a 3-year period of time that ends in December 2002. The search warrant's about a month later. The fact that he's a drug dealer, corroborated by individual number two, who said he deals marijuana. It's also corroborated by a controlled purchase of crack cocaine that occurred in September of 2002. An informant approaches Dante Britt to buy crack cocaine at a parking lot of a CVS pharmacy. Dante Britt doesn't have any crack cocaine in his possession. He goes immediately to Tatu Brown's car, comes back, and gives the informant the crack cocaine. Fair inference that Dante Britt, an overpowering inference that Dante Britt went to Tatu Brown to get the crack cocaine. So we've established that Tatu Brown's a drug dealer. Next, according to the layman standard, we show that he lives at the residence which is to be searched. DEA did some surveillance to corroborate this. They saw Brown carry groceries into the residence, unlock the door with a key, and enter the residence. And they talked to a postal carrier who says that he delivers mail there. We know that Tatu Brown lives there and is a drug dealer. Under Lehman, that's enough to justify the search warrant. On top of that, we have individual number one saying, I've been to that residence before. Tatu Brown's cooked powder cocaine into crack
right.
cocaine.
What's the
before.
Timing, though, of individual one's visit to the residence? Because these are pretty general. Don't you need to have something that makes the information fresh, or that some reason to believe that drugs are there at the given time of the warrant?
I would agree that the question about when it was cooked into crack cocaine is vague, there wasn't a timetable set other than the inference that it occurred over the last 3 years. Yeah, could have been written
I mean, that
better.
Just basically means that's all you need. You know, you need to establish where a drug dealer lived. You need to establish the person's a drug dealer. And then you can go in. Just pick the time you want to go in. I mean, shouldn't there be some time?
Well, Lehman, and there is something else in the case that local task force did surveillance of a guy named Seagram's Post and who went in and came out with a bag that distributes. But
yeah, but then when he came out with the bag, did we know whether Seagram's Post and possessed cocaine for sale rather than use?
No, Your Honor.
So then we're presuming that the backpack contained drug proceeds or drugs?
I think if that's the only thing you have to corroborate the search warrant, it's not a good search warrant. But with everything else present, and again with Lehman, we're not talking about drug trafficking, which this court and others throughout the country has addressed as different than other types of crimes. And this court and others have said that drug dealers keep evidence, not just drugs, evidence of their activity where they live. So according to Lehman, we don't need to even articulate, we've seen him there with drugs at this given time. The fact that he's engaged in ongoing drug trafficking activity that's recent, and he lives at this residence is enough to justify a search warrant in the drug trafficking cases.
Didn't the warrant application link the car that was involved in the controlled buy to the residence? I don't remember. Was that link there?
I'd have to reread it again, to be honest with you. I think it may have, and again, that's something that wouldn't necessarily show, that drugs are there at the house conclusively, but that would be another fact that would link Tattoo Brown to that residence. So, again, this is a case clearly under Lehman and the others that we think the search warrant's valid, and lastly, we'd argue good faith. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Blackington. Mr. Clerk, do anyone have any time left? No? Well, in that case, we'd like to thank all of the attorneys in the case. And Mr. Crawford, we want to give a special thanks to you for having taken this case by appointment. The court deeply appreciates your efforts on behalf of your client. The case will be taken under advisement.